morning. For those who don't know, my name is Stuart James, and I'm one of the BDMs for Aberdeen Asset Management. And today we're presenting on global investing, a whole world opportunity. So first of all, thank you very much for choosing to come along to this session. The main idea behind this particular presentation is to actually challenge some of the common misconceptions or myths behind international portfolio construction. In particular, why some international managers seem to choose to introduce artificial constraints around their portfolio. As international managers, in theory, we can invest in any company in the world, and that's where we think the real opportunity is, and therefore as managers we should use that full opportunity set when we're actually constructing our portfolios. So we're going to do a little bit of myth-busting today. For that we have our resident myth-buster, Mr. Andrew Preston. Andrew's actually in Australia, but he's been with Aberdeen for about 20 years, and just recently he's been based in Edinburgh, up in Scotland, working on our global desk. But prior to that he's an experience in Japanese equities, US equities, he's well travelled, as most Australians are, with a wealth of experience. And being in Scotland, he has a keen eye on price these days, so he certainly doesn't overpay for these stocks either. So with that, I'll introduce you to Andrew, and then at the end we'll have time for some questions. And if any of you, I think everybody has now got a seat, we'll have a few more chairs in. So thank you very much.
Very nice to see such a good crowd here coming to this session. I hope we've got something interesting to tell you and perhaps something interesting that you'll go away with and remember from this part of the conference. As Stuart said, we thought we would approach it by way of looking at some of the misconceptions in the market about global investing and see if we can give you some ideas which perhaps counter some of those misconceptions and show that there are other ways of doing things and perhaps better ways of doing things. The first myth that we thought we would look at is the one that benchmarks what we should be working to. It's very popular to think about benchmarks given that there's so much indexing going on at the moment, and people look at indexing and they think, well, we can do an index fund for half the price or something like that. Why don't we do it? Now, there are some very good reasons, I think, why you should look beyond the index funds and why you should look to actively managed funds. And a few of these are listed here for you at the moment. You can see firstly that benchmarks don't tell you anything about the quality of companies. They don't tell you anything about the detail of the underlying companies in there. Are they good investments? Are they bad investments? What's the management like? What's their history like? Is this the sort of company that's going to do well in the future? We know what it's done in the past because of its position in the benchmark. Is it going to do that in the future? Is it going to be a poor investment going forward? So those sorts of things we don't know about. Benchmarks don't tell you anything about productivity, about world productivity. It's very simple to look around the world and see which areas are thriving and which areas are struggling. If you look at Europe and many of the Western nations, they're struggling at the moment. You look at Asia, you look at China, you look at Latin America. These countries all have thriving economies. So benchmarks can't help you finding where the best areas to invest are. The next one is that biggest isn't necessarily best. We all know the large companies in our index and the other indexes around the world, but they don't always prove to be the best investments. Sometimes if you can get a medium or smaller size company, that company has much better growth prospects, its earnings prospects will be better as well, and so you'll do better investing in that type of company than you will in the biggest company. Index investing or benchmark investing will inevitably lead you to the largest companies in that benchmark. They will be overweighted and the small companies will be underweighted, not necessarily leading into the best result over time. Another obvious example is that benchmark investing would have led you to have more than half of your investments in the US in recent years. We'll look at some performance on the US market that shows that wouldn't have been the place where you want to be. I think the point is that we want to focus on high quality companies and not benchmark companies. So if we look at some examples, we can look at a little bit more detail. Some obvious examples here. Consider population for a start. These are global figures, global statistics. Look at the break between the emerging markets, which in each case is the dark blue bar on the chart, and the developed markets, which are represented by the light blue. Population now, you've got 80% of the population, the world population, is in the emerging markets. Land mass is nearly as much, so foreign exchange reserves, this is really quite an interesting one. For those of you who remember the 90s and the 98s troubles there, foreign exchange reserves are held now much more by the emerging markets than by the developed markets. And this has other implications for currencies, for stability of governments, stability of markets as well. Energy consumption, 50% in the emerging markets now, as well as the developed markets. GDP, not surprisingly, is now 51% in the emerging markets, GDP at purchasing power parity. Exports. This is one of the really big changes, and we'll all be aware that everything we buy now, every piece of technology almost is made in China. Many of the things that we use in our daily lives are all made in China. Exports now from the emerging markets are over 40%. This is up from 20% just in the 70s. So you can see a doubling of exports from the emerging markets. So there are some big changes here. There are some big changes that have been seen in the emerging markets in reality. But look at the market cap of the emerging markets. It's still tiny compared to the market cap of the developed markets. That's 7% of the world market. So looking at that in a little bit more detail on this chart, you can see the, you may not be able to see too well at the back, but the dark grey bars here represent productivity, world GDP in a percent for each of these markets. The light blue bar beside that represents the proportion of the MSCI World Index. And you'll be familiar with these figures, but the obvious one is clearly the US, now representing, as we saw from the earlier charts, only 32% of GDP, but still representing over 50% of the MSCI World Index. So there's a mismatch there. And if you look to the other end of this chart, you'll see the emerging markets, emerging Asia, Latin America, and the other smaller markets. These represent now 24% of global GDP, but are only 7% of the market cap of the MSCI World Index. So we've got a big mismatch here between the reality and the benchmarks that we're looking at. If you look at on a company basis and on a country basis, you can see also that the performance in the developed markets has lagged the performance in the emerging markets. We take the obvious example of the US. In 2006, the figures all there go up to December 2006. So you've got 2006, the US market returned 1.2%. So if you had your 50% of your benchmark in the US market, you would return 1.2% or half of 1.2% for that year, which is not a great return. You look down the page to the Latin American markets. In 2006, you saw a return there of 25.9%. So a dramatic improvement by investing away from the benchmark and having more of your investments in the emerging markets or the high growth markets, the higher growth markets that we've seen. The same thing happens if you look up at Japan. You may remember on the previous chart, we had Japan is actually one of the few countries where the GDP actually matches the market cap above 11% for each case. So in that case, even if you had a full weighting in Japan through this period, you still would have underperformed, because Japan, as we know, since the 90s, has been a very poor performer globally. And as you can see, over a 10-year period, has returned only 0.9%. So a benchmark weight in Japan, an 11% weight in Japan, would not have been a beneficial way to go through this period. If we look at the next myth two, if you like, diversification is about having a large number of portfolio stocks. I believe you've had a very detailed session this morning on portfolio theory, so I don't need to remind you of any of the detail of that at this stage. But as you know, the bottom line of portfolio theory is that if you invest in a series of uncorrelated companies and markets, this will reduce the risk of your portfolio. So if you invest, and you don't have to invest in a large number of companies to do that, research shows that even 20 to 25 companies which are uncorrelated, i.e. they don't move in the same direction at the same time within a market, even that level of diversification will reduce your risk. Other ways to reduce your risk are to invest in more than one market. So even by, for example, taking a US investor, by halving his investments in the US and putting half of those investments outside the US, because the markets are less correlated and the stocks and companies are less correlated, the risk is reduced by doing those investments. So what we're saying here is that you don't need a huge number of stocks in the portfolio to reduce your risk. It simply comes down to which stocks you choose, which markets and which sectors. And if you have that those uncorrelated stocks and markets and sectors, then you will return, your risk will be reduced in the portfolio. To give you an example, we took on a portfolio from a competitor about 2 years ago. It was a global portfolio. When we took it on, it had something like 125 stocks in it. 125 stocks. You would say we're giving quite a bit of diversification, quite a bit of risk mitigation. The other side of that is that if you have one of those stocks which doubles in value, you get almost no performance benefit in your total portfolio. So when we took on that portfolio, we reduced it, we rationalized the holdings in that portfolio to down to less than 50. So as one of my clients said many years ago, you have more than 100 stocks in your portfolio, you have a pudding. I think that's it's quite an interesting way to think about it. But anyway, the bottom line here is that diversification is not about the number of stocks, but the way you choose the stocks, whether you choose good companies. And if you have those good companies, then your risk will be reduced as a result. Here's another example of some typical companies that you'll know. Most of these you'll know as household names, from the US stocks to the UK stocks. What we need and what we enjoy as global managers is to have the flexibility to invest in this global universe. As I said before, by diversifying across the global universe, you'll reduce your risk. Some people, some of our colleagues, for example, in the UK might choose HSBC and say, well, HSBC is a great company, it's a good solid bank, it has investments throughout the world, it has operations in every country, virtually almost every city. But it's still a UK company. And it's still going to perform in a very similar fashion to many other UK companies. So in fact, you won't be diversifying away your risk. And if you have a global portfolio, why not take advantage of the opportunities that it gives you? If you're looking to get exposure to Asia, invest in ICICI Bank in India, which has performed really very well over the past few years and was selling on a much cheaper rating than HSBC. Or Bradesco, the largest retail bank in Brazil, once again performing very well in recent years and has been on a cheaper rating than many of the other banks in the UK, US or elsewhere. So the important point is that there are many opportunities there and there are many valuation opportunities if we look at investing across countries. Third point is that economic factors should dictate investment strategies. Well, we've hinted this in the first few slides, that economic factors are important, and you can't ignore them. But it's more important when you're finally building your portfolio to look at the bottom-up issues, to look at the individual companies, to make sure you have those the best companies in your portfolio. I think if you look at some examples around the world, China now, there are many companies in China. There are many new companies coming to the market in China. We've seen all the new A-share companies that are listed for the domestic investors to buy in China. Now, excuse me, because of the demand for these companies and because of the limited number of the companies, and as we've seen all these pictures of Chinese from the countryside selling their house and getting some money and then rushing to a broker in the city and putting it all in the market. these A shares now are selling, where the A shares are also quoted in Hong Kong as H shares, dual listed companies. The domestic ones in China now are selling on something like a 40% premium to the Hong Kong shares. So you have to be careful how you buy a company. You have to know the background of the company. You have to know the background of where you can buy that company most efficiently and best. So, and the other aspects about Chinese companies are that there are many good companies and there are many poor companies. There's still dual controls in Chinese companies where you have two layers of control. You have a corporate layer of control and then you have a party layer of control in most companies. And you don't know what's happening with that second layer of control, how important it is or otherwise. So it's another issue. It just puts a question mark. This comes back to the question of corporate governance. Are you happy with the corporate governance of these companies? Are you not happy with the corporate governance? The quality, the supply chain issues, all these sorts of things. If you have an issue with a domestic Chinese company as an investor or as another manufacturer, it's often very difficult to resolve that issue because there are many rules in the Chinese economy and the financial world, but it's often very difficult to get those rules enforced or followed up. So although the background looks to be satisfactory, in reality it can be quite difficult. There's a great example, in fact, which happened just today. I'm sure you all saw in the news this morning that Mattel, the US toy company, has just announced a global recall of products that were made in China, something like 19 million toys. It's called back from all over the world. I think it's about 500,000 in Australia that have been recalled. It's quality control. There's lead in the paint of some of these things, and there are smaller things that if a child puts them in their mouth, they might choke. So these sort of issues are still not quite right in China in some cases. So what we're saying here is that you need to know the companies. You need to know the companies that you're investing in. You need to have confidence that your investment managers know these companies and will avoid some of the poor companies and make sure they get some of the better companies. One of the ways that we tend to do it is to invest more via Hong Kong in the Hong Kong listed companies, because Hong Kong listed companies meet all the requirements of the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. So you can be confident of their corporate governance and their shareholders' treatment and their transparency and all these important issues. Just as you can't say that a bad country shouldn't have any good companies. You can look at issues like the crisis in Thailand where the government was overthrown. Various other things happened, but in fact, when you look at the companies underlying that, the domestic companies in Thailand, they sailed through this crisis. And although you had a hiccup in prices at the time of the coup, there were still some good opportunities there. So it's a question of sometimes in bad economies, bad countries, you can find good investments. Sometimes in poor countries, poorly governed, sometimes in good countries, you can find bad investments. So you have to be careful with your selection and your choice on the way through. Myth four that we'd like to look at is thematic investments. Thematic investment is the future. We've seen a lot of themes come and go in the past few years. Sometimes they're short-lived, sometimes they're longer-lived. If you think the aging population, uranium in Australia has been a great example. Technology in 1999, how many tech companies went up in that very short period and crashed in 2000. Corporate governance became a byword after Enron. Corporate governance was actually quite important before Enron, but people started to focus on it after the Enron situation, and then looked at other companies and suspected they might have corporate governance issues as well. The environment. I'm sure you've all seen Al Gore's movie now and know what the future brings for all of us. That's an important thing. Alternative energy is something which comes out of that. All these things are important, but they all take time to play out. And quite often you'll find that if you try and invest according to a theme, everyone else is doing the same thing. by the time you get to the wind farm operator, the price of that has already risen by 50%, 70%. So you're buying a very expensive company instead of a good investment. So what we're saying here is that we need to be aware of these things, and we must be cognizant of them in our investment process. But we must still look at the value, the valuation of stocks under those circumstances. If we're going to make good investments for our clients, we need to be aware that we shouldn't overpay. As Stuart said before, we don't believe in overpaying. Another theme is that the emerging markets themselves are a risky asset class. I think those of you with memories to the 90s, the 98s, and the currency crises that started in Asia and went right through Russia down to Latin America when they finished, and currencies collapsed, markets collapsed one after the other in a very dramatic fashion. That showed the emerging markets in a fairly unattractive light, and it gave people some concerns about what the actual situation was. One of the phrases in investment is this time is different. And I say that's the most expensive and the most dangerous thing you can say. I think in this case, though, we have seen changes, and we have seen important changes and dramatic changes in the emerging markets. And those changes go through development of GDP growth. The populations are young, so we're seeing productivity is high in the emerging markets. Consumer spending is developing. Some 55% of Indians are under the age of 25. So that's the consumers of the future. These people now are a new class in themselves in every one of the developing markets. Whereas in the 1990s, most of the developing economies had borrowed heavily in US dollars. And if you remember, it was the strengthening of the US dollar that put the squeeze on those companies and those countries. They couldn't afford the repayments. So one after the other, their currencies collapsed. It's curious now that if you look at the earlier chart that I showed you, where it showed forex reserves, are now 60% held by the emerging markets. So the emerging markets have had enormous exports. As a result of those strong exports, they've been rebuilding their balance of payments, and they've been rebuilding their domestic finances. They've been paying back debt. So they're actually in a very healthy position compared to where they were before. I haven't got a breakdown here, but it is very heavily dominated by China and the Asian. China has over $1 trillion of foreign exchange reserves now, US dollars, $1 trillion. So it's quite a lot, but it is very heavily weighted in there, and it's the result of the export phenomenon. So these things have changed. Not only the external situations, but it's also the internal, the domestic situations. The balance sheets of companies are now looking much more better, much stronger. They're more profitable, they're cleaner, they're easier to understand. The corporate governance has improved, and they're also looking to shareholders as real people, as real investors. Whereas going back a few years, many of the companies in the emerging markets were managed for the company themselves or a family. In Asia, you still have to be careful because many of the companies throughout Asia are still perhaps up to 50% owned by a family. But it just means that you must look into the corporate governance of those companies even more carefully to understand how they're being managed and to make sure they're being managed on behalf of shareholders. But these changes have occurred. They're now offering better dividends to their shareholders. China Mobile, the biggest mobile phone company in the world, has now a 2% yield to shareholders. So when you look at companies that are actually looking after their shareholders, they're paying dividends back to their shareholders, you know they're valuing their shareholders, and that's a very good sign for the future. And the bottom line is that because these companies are doing so well, their valuations are reasonable as well. And you can often find cheaper companies in the emerging markets. Volatility, we've all been worried about volatility in the emerging markets. Well, that has changed dramatically too. And if you look at the volatility in emerging markets over a 20-year period, from starting in 1990 to today, you can see that it's almost halved over that period. So, whereas we used to be very concerned about that volatility, it's now becoming far less so. And the reason for that being far less so is that the fundamentals are actually much better in those markets. One of the interesting things is that you can reduce risk by investing in the emerging markets as well. As we said earlier, the chart here, the Efficient Frontiers chart you'll have seen and perhaps talked about this morning as well. But this is compiled from statistics from the MSCI, so it's not something that we've put together ourselves, and most people have seen this from various other presentations already. But you can see that the bottom of the red line here represents portfolios which are invested 100% in the MSCI world, so that's in basically the developed markets. The top of the line represents, this is the risk profile of portfolios invested 100% in the emerging markets. And each of the points on that line represents the 5% change move between those two positions. So that you can see that your return is on the annualized returns on the left-hand bar. So that you can see 100% in the MSCI world over the past 5 years would have generated an annualized return of just under 6%. Now, by increasing your exposure to the emerging markets as you go up the bar, up the chart, you're actually reducing your risk because of your investment in uncorrelated assets. So that's actually reducing the overall risk of your portfolio. So that's why the line goes towards the left. It's showing there's lower risk up to the point approximately halfway up the page there. Now, if you exceed that point, which is around about a 12% return point there for the period. If you exceed that point, you do start to increase your risk by adding further to the emerging markets. But it's not until the point where you're nearly at approximately a 16% return there, where you can see that your risk profile is the same as it would have been had you invested only in the MSCI world. The benefit of doing that is that your return has increased by some 10% by increasing your exposure to the uncorrelated markets, to the emerging markets in this case. So, in fact, as we say, you can actually reduce your risk by investing up to a portion in the emerging markets. Myth 6. Global equity portfolios have outperformed because of their overweight in the emerging markets. I think this is not an asset allocation decision. It comes back to what we were saying before. It depends entirely on which companies you invest in the emerging markets. And so long as you invest in quality companies in the emerging markets, then you'll be investing in good companies, good investments, and you will be improving your returns. So you must look at the specific companies that you have in your portfolio. The energy sector, as we say here, provides an interesting example. Petrobras, the Brazilian oil company, is cheaper than BP in the UK, but it also has vastly superior resources, vastly superior reserves. It also has better production growth and a longer life. So if we compare that on this chart here, you can see that BP, the metrics of BP look fine, they look okay, but if you look at the reserves BP has, they're very, very much smaller. I mean, BP has expanded into the US, it's had issues in Texas, it's had issues in Canada, where they pipeline issues. It's looking around the world to buy assets to support its growth for the future. But Petrobras has proven reserves for some 19 years already, and this year it announced another major improvement on those reserves. Then if you look at the metrics of Petrobras, prospective PE 5.8 for next year, price to book only 1.8, dividend yield 4.8%. And these are quite attractive metrics for any company. And if you take it back to my earlier comments on emerging markets generally and on Brazil in particular, where you don't have the concerns that you had 10 years ago with the currency, if you can find a company which is as cheap as this and attractive as this and on good prospective earnings as this, then I think it's a very wise, it's a very good investment for the future. PetroChina, the company just above it, once again, they're selling on a reasonable rating and has just announced an 8.1 million barrel increase in its reserves. So these companies are looking good, looking like good investments for the future, and I think will continue to be so. Myth 7, anyone can invest in the emerging markets. We've had a good run in the emerging markets, there's no doubt. Investors are perhaps becoming a little bit blasé about them. Well, we've seen a little bit of a wake-up call over the last week or so in markets generally. But political risks are there. We need to look at companies, specific companies. If you're looking at managers, you need to look at a manager who has experience in emerging markets, has done this for some time, and can spot the good companies from the bad companies. I think that's the key. We need to have the skills, we need to have the knowledge and the background to be able to avoid those pitfalls. And whilst anyone can invest in an emerging markets index, if you want to invest in good companies and avoid the pitfalls, I think you need that experience to do so. Myth 8, volatility is your enemy. We did see a lot of volatility in the emerging markets over the past few years. That's calmed down, as the earlier chart I showed you demonstrated. This is a chart taken from Bloomberg of Petrobras showing how we have traded that as a stock. And you can see that volatility is no bad thing. If you're an investment manager, you like a little bit of a dip in the markets to be able to get in and buy. If you've got some cash to put into the markets and you need to invest, it's always better if you can see a little bit of a correction and add it on that correction. So volatility is definitely not... is definitely not an issue as far as we're concerned. We have no concerns. The main thing is that we know our companies, and if we know our companies and we do see a fall in the market, then we're very happy to go and buy some more. Very happy to go and buy some more, and that provides a nice opportunity to top up all that and to hold it. So I think you can take that as a very positive one. Myth 9 now, we're nearly getting near the end here. So, only two more to go. Active management is about high turnover. Well, all we would say is that this is not necessarily the case. Active management is about making the right decisions. There is no reason why you shouldn't be an active manager and hold your investments for 2, 3, 4 years. Our holding period is normally 3 to 4 years at least, and some of the stocks in our portfolios we've held for 5, 6 years even. Quality is there and the valuation is there, then there is no need to churn your portfolio. Sometimes an active decision may be to make no change at all to your portfolio, just to hold it there. So we believe in just keeping it. Once you have your portfolio in place, you're happy with the stocks, you're comfortable with the managements, you know the companies, the lower the turnover is better. So it doesn't necessarily mean high turnover at all. Finally, myth 10. The aim of portfolio management is to have all stocks performing strongly. Well, as portfolio managers, we would love all our stocks to be performing strongly all the time. Sadly, that doesn't always happen. But it's no bad thing. because if you've got an uncorrelated portfolio of global stocks, then there are bound to be some companies which are outperforming, and there are bound to be some companies, sectors or countries which are underperforming. So the ideal world is to take a long-term view, to be able to take advantage of some of those poorly performing stocks, to add to them, to top slice some of your outperforming stocks, and to build the quality of your portfolio, to sustain the quality of your portfolio over time. And if you have uncorrelated stocks and you have your appropriate diversification, that will allow you to go through that process and to maintain your portfolio, to build it and to build returns over time. So really, that's the total. In summary, globalization has changed the way we look at markets, has changed the way companies operate, and I think has changed the way investors should look at companies and treat companies going forward. Investment managers themselves should be confident and not be constrained by benchmarks, but they should be happy to invest away from benchmarks, but being aware of what the benchmark is, where it is, and what those variations are. But at the end of the day, we believe strongly that quality companies will outperform. That's the key view. Investors in those quality companies, irrespective of market capitalization, sector or location, if you're investing in those quality companies, you get good returns in the long term. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew. Hopefully Andrew's going to be some interesting points to think about. Yes, and we're being the impact targets. What we're trying to really show here is that there's lots of different ways to invest in international markets. We're not necessarily trying to suggest one way is better than another. Obviously, index managers have their place. But certainly if you're spending money and paying active fees for a positive benchmark hooker, I think you should know exactly how your international manager is viewing the world. If they have 50% in the US, is that because they think half, well, basically they find half the best companies in the world in the US? Or is it because they're managing to a benchmark? What is their portfolio turnover? If they are investing in emerging markets, how are they selecting those companies? Is it purely because they're picking the largest cap stocks in emerging markets? Or is it because they actually have gone on a play, flow to Brazil, met with management, and they've actually analysed those companies? So what we're trying to challenge you or ask you is, you know, speak to your international managers and find out how they view the world and exactly what's driving their stock decisions. Is it simply the benchmark, or are they actually actively trying to add value using their own skills? This is the short piece of time I've got to do a product flow. I guess it won't surprise you when you look at the Aberdeen International Fund. We are a very active manager. We do ignore the benchmark when we're looking to put together our portfolios. We have around about 100 portfolio managers worldwide, located in the US, Europe, Asia, etc. And all these managers are actually going out day after day to meet with company management to actually assess companies from a bottom-up level, then putting together a very concentrated portfolio, normally around 50 stocks, very low turnover. So in that sense, we're a very high conviction manager, and that's adding a lot of value over time. Certainly, on most of your chairs, you'll have a fact sheet on the fund. You'll see from there how well the fund has performed. You'll also see when you look at the country allocation, that basically we do exactly what we say. You'll see there that we're actually around about 30%, or almost 30% of the way in the US. Hopefully, Zander has explained that's not a macro call. What you simply see here is where we're underweight, we either can't find good quality or companies are expensive. Even where we're overweight, we can find good quality companies which trade at relatively attractive valuations. But at the moment, we're not particularly bearish on US companies. We find a lot of good quality companies there, but generally they tend to be expensive. Certainly compared to some of the companies we can find in emerging markets. Certainly not many international firms you'll find whose largest holding is a Brazilian oil company, i.e. Petrobras. So, certainly welcome the opportunity to talk to any of you during the conference if you're interested in our views on the world and certainly how that fund's performed and how we've got it weighted relative to some of our peers. And now I guess the only thing to do is ask you if anybody's got any questions, either for myself or Andrew.